My name is Richard Lamparsky, and I cannot tell you how I've been looking forward to doing this broadcast, because along about, I think it was about 4:45 every afternoon, all through grade school and through more of high school than I'd care to admit, I was glued to my radio, listening on ABC at that time, or the Blue Network, depending on your age, to the all-American boy, Jack Armstrong, who one of them is sitting here in the studio with me today. And I think for those of you who won't remember, you'll get a big surprise when he tells you what his name is. Would you like to introduce yourself?
Richard. My name is Jim Amici.
You wouldn't even have to say it with that voice. You can only be one of the two, Jim or Doc. Do many people know you were Jack Armstrong?
I rather imagine so, Richard, possibly within the business. I don't know how many outside of the business know it.
There were, according to this book, The Golden Age of Radio, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. 5 Jack Armstrongs. You were the second.
No, I was number one.
Oh, really? Because they had St. John Terrell as the one in 1933.
No,
you were 33 to 38.
33 to 38 at the beginning of 39.
And your brother was on the show, too. What was the name of his character?
He was Captain Hughes. Only about the first 3 months, and there was too much of a similarity in the voices, so Don got canceled.
Where was the show done from originally?
It was done from, we started on WBBM. In Chicago. It was originally carried over the CBS network, coast to coast.
And I remember it on ABC.
Yes. Well, we started on CBS. We did it there for, from 33 to 35 or 36. And then we switched to NBC. And it was still on NBC at the time that I left.
That was one of the very early, I was going to say kid show, but it wasn't really a kid show. It was adventure serial.
Adventure serial. The only one that I can remember that preceded it in national scope and importance was a show called Skippy.
I don't remember Skippy.
You don't remember Skippy. Well, it probably goes back before your years, but I think Skippy started around 1930 and had a fair amount of success, and then Armstrong started, and I was the original. I started it right from the word go in 1933, in July of 1933, and we had a simply phenomenal success as far as acceptance with the American people was concerned.
I don't know of a single program of that type that really gets people as excited today as that does. You know, The Shadow, which is pretty popular, you know, and the Green Hornet and people like that on this program.
But, yes.
But Jack Armstrong seems to have hit, maybe it was right, the All-American Boy, maybe that was it.
I don't know what it was, but I guess there was some kind of magic about it. I can give you one of the facets of it. I mean, how tremendously accepted it was. The first contest that we ever ran on the show, just through General Mills, completely awry. We ran it for 3 weeks. I forget what the giveaway was. I think the kids had to send in a dime and a box top, and I don't know what it was they received. It could have been a ring or a whistle or something. But in the course of that 3 weeks, this is the first contest they ever ran on the show, they cleaned every Wheaties box off every grocery shelf in America. And it so discombobulated the structure of resurfacing the stores that it took them like 6 months before they got Wheaties back into the stores in America. So after the first one, they would have freight cars loaded at certain strategic areas across the nation to supplant the Wheaties as they were bought off the shelves. So you want to talk about successful salesmanship. I doubt very much whether this could ever happen in America today.
No,
just,
you know,
phenomenal.
I think it's even more successful than it sounds, retelling it now, because this was in, would it be the first year?
It was probably in 33. It might have been the beginning of 34, because we started in July of 33.
But in either year, a dime and a box of Wheaties was a lot of money.
Was a lot of money.
Relief for people who were working
right.
2 or 3 days a week.
Right, because this is right.
Kids today don't understand that.
Mid-depression.
You asked for a dime then, and it was like asking for a dollar and a half now.
Yeah, or maybe $2.
Right, yeah, because many times there just wasn't a dime. It wasn't a question of being cheap or 50,
It was just just phenomenal.
Did you start your radio career in Chicago?
Yes. Well, actually, I did some amateur work in Kenosha, Wisconsin, which was my hometown back in my high school days. I worked with a couple of fellas there. One of them is Irving Wallace, the writer now. Irving and myself and a fellow by the name of Walter Hardy, who is in production TV work on the West Coast now. And I Ed Roberts, who is an announcer in Chicago now. We were all on the debating team and on the oratorical team and so forth all through high school. And we used to go up on Saturday mornings and clown around with a little skit that we used to put together. We called ourselves the Four Sparks Brothers, a takeoff on Marx Brothers. They were tremendously popular at that time. They were just getting their careers underway. And that was where I actually got my first taste of radio.
Was Jack Armstrong the first big running role that you had?
Yes, that was the first one. I had never done any professional radio up to that point. And they auditioned for months ahead of time. They must have had 500 or 600 different voices from all around the country that they listened to. And finally,
Did your voice become too mature for the role?
No. That wasn't it. I just moved on to other things. I moved out to the West Coast in 39.
I think if our engineer is ready, we might give the audience a taste of what we're talking about when we talk about what an exciting program that was. We have here, courtesy of the Long Gene Sinfonette, who put out a number of records on old-time radio, the beginning and just an introduction of an old episode of Jack Armstrong, the All-American Boy. I expect it's been some time since Jim Amici's heard this, since I have, too. So let's, are we ready with the record? Here we go with, this is what it sounded like.
Have you tried, Wheaties, their whole wheat with all of the bran?
Jack Armstrong, the All-American Boy.
Wave the flag for Hudson Park.
Bring you the thrilling adventures of Jack Armstrong, the All-American Boy. Jack Armstrong is climbing up the dangerous mountain trail to the cave of the glacier. High above him, the towering peaks of the Andes press their eternal snows against the South American sky. And far below lies the valley with its hotel, winter sports. Jack and his friends are seeking Whisper, whom the enemy agent Lazaro has captured and brought to the cave of the glacier. Right now, Uncle Jim leads the way with Senor Quesada, the Secret Service man whom they rescued from the enemy agent, and Jack and Billy and Betty follow not far behind.
Did I hear one of the kids mention our old friend?
Well, that really took me back. How long has it been since you've heard that, Jim Amici?
Oh, gosh, Richard. It's been a great many years, I guess.
Can you date it? You know the announcer? Or?
Yes, I can date it. At least I can post-date it, let me put it that way. That was Franklin McCormick doing the announcing. Now, Frank, or Mac, as we used to call him back in Chicago, had not started announcing the show at the time I left, so this must have been from 1939 or 1940. Actually, to the best of my knowledge, we have attempted, in time gone past, we've even contacted General Mills. I do not believe there is any recording of my voice during the years that I did it. This was in pre-recording days. Actually, the way we recorded back at that time was right to a large, heavy wax disc that was maybe 3 inches in thickness. And we had to make and this was the original, this was the matrix. From this they made the stampers. And then the discs were sent out. The only reason we did that was that with CBS, I think there were something like 95 or 96 stations that CBS had throughout the country at that point, and General Mills wanted it in 28 additional cities. So we had to record 3 weeks ahead of time. This is how long it took to get the stampers and the pressings out. So we recorded the show 3 weeks ahead of time up at the old World Studios on top of the Daily News building in Chicago. And that, incidentally, it might be interesting for you to note that these were the studios that transmitted the first television broadcasts in the United States, maybe in the world, back in 1929. And, of course, it didn't turn out well, so it was reconverted to a recording studio, a massive studio. It covered almost the entire top floor of the Daily News building, and it was right on the top floor of the building, and the sun beat right down on the top. And it was a steel-constructed building, and during the summer, of course, air conditioning hadn't even been dreamed of at that time. It became so hot in there, we would have to take off our shirts and just work naked to the waist, especially if we had running scenes to do. Because if we ran, we ran. whatever was called upon, you did it. You did it for good. And now, let's see. At the time when I first started the show, David Owen was the producer and director, and he did the announcing. He did it for the first 3 years. Then Truman Bradley. Does that ring a bell with you?
Oh, yes.
Well, Truman Bradley was the next announcer while I was on it, and I believe he did it for another 2 or 3 years. And then Tom Shirley was the last announcer who did it during the years that I was on the show. Those were the only three announcers that we had in the years I did it. And Tom Shirley, I believe, just passed away a couple of years ago. He's a very dear old friend of mine. And also, the opening theme song, the Wave the Flag for Hudson High Boys, when we started it, we had a group of fellas that came from Minneapolis, Minnesota. They were called the Norsemen, an appropriate enough title, I guess. And I do not believe this was the same group. They did it through all the years that I did the show. And we had a very peculiar incident that happened when we first started the theme song, and oh, for about the first year, maybe year and a half, it was Wave the Flag for Hudson High, boys, show them where we stand, wave the flag for Hudson High, boys, da-da-da-da-da, boola-boola, boola-boola, and then they go into Jack Armstrong, Jack Armstrong. Well, Yale University jumped, descended, with a whole staff of lawyers along about the middle of the second year, claiming that we could not use the words boola boola over the air because this was part of their school song. So they had to give it up. They had to rewrite the song. They had to rewrite the opening.
How could they have kept their face straight in court?
Well, that was the way it went. I don't think they ever took it to court, but they descended with a whole roster of them. And so we had to cut out the words boola boola.
When we were listening just now to the that old segment or the introduction to the drama that was to follow, it occurred to me, I remember my grandmother used to pass by sometimes when as I would be listening to it, you know, dusting or making dinner or something. She would listen for a minute. She said, "That boy is never in school." Was he ever? I don't ever remember him being in
school. Oh, yes, yes. In the years I did it, we were in school some of the time. We were out of school a great bit of the time.
You mean they were in craters in Peru?
We would run sequences that would involve football games at home, hockey games, baseball. I mean, we ran the complete gamut of sports. And then, of course, we'd go away in these junkets. I think maybe in the first few years we paid a little more attention to what was transpiring as far as the school year itself was concerned. I think we confined ourselves to our junkets during the summer months. But that changed as time went by.
You mentioned some of the one of the offers, and you said you didn't know what it was. I remember there was a whistling ring, and because I had one. I had a whistling ring from Jack Armstrong, and I hope you brought it with me, the walk-a-meter. I never got that, Mr. Amici. The walk-a-meter.
I think this was after I had left.
Oh, really? Who would I contact? I really
General Mills. Take it up
General
with that.
Mills. And there was a bomb site, some kind of a bomb site. That was long near in the 40s, I'd say early 40s.
Yes, because we had the precinct. I don't think they had bomb sites when I did the show.
Yeah, there was a man named
Mr. We had very few planes, as a matter of fact.
There was a painter by the name of Mr. Pung. I thought that was a wonderful name. He was painting my grandmother's house, and I just begged her for a bomb site, and evidently I must have helped him mix the paint or something, and because he gave me one of the 14, 15 cents or whatever it was, and I did get a bomb site. I had a Wheaties box top, because of course I ate Wheaties.
Uh-huh.
You got a lifetime supply, didn't you? Sure.
No, I don't think they ever sent us a box of Wheaties as long as we did the show. You know, going back to the way we used to make transcriptions, they were called transcriptions in those days, with these large wax discs. And if you made a mistake, there was a shaving device that just slid right across the top of the wax, and it was shaved clean again, just bright and shiny and sparkling like a glossy plate glass top. And then you'd start over again. And in other words, not like today, where if you make a mistake, you pay no attention to it, you can go back in, snip the tape, or do whatever you have to do. But back then, for 14 minutes and 30 seconds, we had to produce a show that was absolutely flawless. There were no mistakes in it. If there was a mistake, we started again. Well, I remember once, and this used to be a pretty horrendous experience, because we could spend... Every once in a while, you'd happen to hit a script that seemed to be a Jonah. And I remember one of these sessions, we had started the show. Let's see, we used to record in the mornings from 9 a.m. to 12:30. Then we took time out for a lunch break, and then we'd go over to the studios, over to CBS, and rehearse for the live afternoon show. And I think we had spent something like 4 days working from 9 in the morning to 12:30 on one 15-minute show. And everywhere, somewhere along the line, there was a goof. And finally, on the take prior to the last one, we had gone practically all the way through it. The announcer was already in the closing announcement. And one of the fellas in the cast, Henry Sachs, his name was, I don't remember what character he used to play. I guess he used to play a great number of characters on it. He had backed up next to a large tub of water. All sound effects were done with sound effects men. I mean, nothing was put on record. Everything was live. If you had horses' hoofs, they had the coconut shells. If you splashed in water, they had water that you splashed in. If you were thrown in water, they had a sack of sand that they would throw into it. Well, it was this large tub of water. And poor Henry Sachs, he was standing right in front of me. He took one backward step, and that was just enough to hit the edge of the tub. He lost his balance and let out a whoop, and into the tub he went with a tremendous splash of water. So that chalk bet went off. We had to do it again. I think that was the 19th take, and the next one worked. We finally got it. But, oh, talk about work.
Wasn't that good training, though?
Magnificent training. We had the greatest instructors in the world back in the early years in Chicago, because they were all perfectionists. They would take you over. If you didn't have the right intonation in a word, they could drive you right out of your mind, because he would take you over that, even one word, 100, 200 times, and you're trying with all your heart and soul to do it. I've seen more men and women break up in those studios just from sheer, utter frustration. But meticulous to detail and time-consumed in perfecting any sound effect or any feeling of a scene was... You just don't see this in the business today. This is from a time and an era gone by. But it made a perfectionist out of everyone who worked with them. And I have a basic feeling that part of this was because of the fact that at that particular time, a lot of the people who were getting into radio were coming in from the stock companies. And in stock companies, you never attained maturity until maybe you had worked a company for 20 years, because you were an apprentice. You learned everything from sweeping the floor on up to designing sets to doing minor lines to working yourself on up to a major role. And everything had to be done by the clock, and it just had to be perfection as you went along. And these were the men who were our early directors and producers. And the same laws went here. Everything had to be perfect. It made no difference whether you were the star of the show or whether you were an extra. The star could be chewed out just as much as the extra. There was no such thing as star status. It just didn't exist, even if you were the star of it. You worked just as hard and just as meticulously to perfection as it was humanly possible to get out of a person. But it was magnificent training. I've never resented any of it. At the time, I think you'd go out of your mind many, many times. But as the years have gone by, there was one thing that they made you feel, that you could not open your mouth unless what you said you believed. That this was the basic training that you got out of it for whatever kind of character you portrayed. And it was magnificent training.
Chicago was the big radio hub in those days, wasn't it?
Yes, it was the hub. And there was a basic reason for that. Because back in the early days, you said you heard the show over the Blue Network. Well,
right.
There was no Blue Network. There was NBC, Red, and Blue, but it was all NBC. They had a red leg and they had a blue leg. And then there was CBS. And what were we discussing?
Chicago being the hub.
And the reason that Chicago became the hub was that a national advertiser could buy time and shoot it over the red leg of the network and over the blue leg of the network, and it cost him less money to originate in Chicago. If he originated in New York, his line charges were like 3-1 over what they would be to cover the country from Chicago. And that was why Chicago became the hub of the radio industry. Then in 1936, when the coaxial cable was finally perfected, that was from that point on, gradually, network radio began to leave Chicago and go on to the East Coast and the West Coast, because it cost no... You could originate a show anywhere in the nation, and it cost you no more money.
Isn't that funny? Now, I've never heard that before, and I've discussed Chicago being the radio capital in the 30s with any number of people.
Yes, well, that
who were around
that was
never
the reason.
It.
That was the reason. A purely economical one. And, of course, we... there were so many of the great early radio shows that originated from there, just because of that one reason.
Now, you've worked both television and radio. Do you like radio best?
I like radio best. That's my first love.
You seem very
I'm
comfortable
I'm stuck with
mic
it.
And what else do you do on television?
Well, I've done a few things in front of them. I think altogether I've done over 60,000 radio shows. I don't know whether there's anybody on the earth who has done more than that. And I don't mean just spot announcements. I mean shows.
Broadcasts.
Mm-hmm.
Is there any other running part you played that we might remember?
Let's see. I did After Don Left for the Coast. I took over the lead on Grand Hotel. I did that. Ann Seymour was my leading lady. And I did that for several seasons.
Was that from Chicago, too?
Yes, that was from Chicago.
I used to know Vicki Baum, God rest her soul.
And then, of course, I did a few things on First Nighter when Don was gone.
You know, a lot of people think your brother was Mr. First Nighter, and of course he wasn't, was he?
No, he wasn't.
He was the actor.
He was the lead.
I do remember him on that, but I don't remember his leading lady. I remember Barbara Luddy and Olin Soule and Les Tremaine. Who was Don?
No, Don started First Nighter in 1930, and it became the first smash dramatic show that the United States ever had. On Friday nights at 7:30 or 8:30, whenever it came on the air, it had phenomenal ratings like the shows just don't build anymore. Much higher than even, great Hollywood...
Lux Radio Theater.
Much higher than Lux Radio Theater ever hit. And he started that in 1930, and June Meredith was his leading lady. And a fellow by the name of Charles Hughes, was the original First Nighter. Now, how long he continued to be the First Nighter, he introduced the show.
Sure, I remember.
But Don was the leading man, and June Meredith was his leading lady.
He was the fellow who managed to get a cab in Times Square just by walking out of the theater.
No.
Since I lived in New York, I never could figure that out.
And then when Don moved to the West Coast with the show in 1936, that was when he was signed by 20th Century Fox, June Meredith did not leave Chicago, and Barbara Luddy, that was where Barbara Luddy became the leading lady, opposite Don.
She had that for years, I think.
Yes. And then Don gave up First Nighter to do the MC work on the Chase and Sanborn Hour, and that was when Les Tremaine took over the lead on First Nighter. That wasn't until 1937, possibly 38.
Does he have a warm spot in his heart for radio, too?
Don?
Yeah.
Oh, yes. Yes, very much so.
I'm going to ask you about the similarity in your voices and your appearances. Is that something that runs in a family, the voice?
I don't know.
A couple of times I've known brothers.
Yeah, I guess it occasionally happens, but not very often.
Because there are two other brothers. Distinctive voices.
There are two other brothers in our family, and they don't sound like either one of us nor like each other.
Do they look alike?
No.
You look amazingly alike, too, I think.
Not particularly.
Who's the older?
Don is. Don is by, seven and a half years, 8 years, I guess.
We're heard on the West Coast, too. Do they know what you're doing out there? Do they know you're on WHN? Or I guess your commercials are heard out there, too.
I guess so, Richard. I imagine so.
You mentioned
something about going to be heard in San Francisco?
San Francisco.
Yes. We have a very interesting project underway, which may be on the air by the time this is played out there. I'm going to be reading, are you familiar with Herb Cain?
Oh, sure,
Mr. San Francisco.
Of course. He's the one who coined Beatnik, among other things.
That's right. He's a wonderful columnist.
He writes a very good column.
My wife, Mary, and I, we just love him. We think he's great. And for the first time, he's granted permission for somebody to read his columns over the air, and I was the guy that was selected. So I'll be doing a 5-minute bit on NBC. In the evenings, reading Herb Cain.
Will you go out there to do it? Or
no, I'll be doing it back
here. They're mailed in, and then you tape them here?
Yes.
Yeah, he writes very, very clever.
Yes.
He really knows that city.
He sure does.
Which is a good city to know.
Yeah, so
do you spend much time there?
We spend time there anytime we get the opportunity, don't we, darling?
The only show I know, a radio show that came out of there that I recall, was One Man's Family.
One Man's Family,
was
yes.
Was there any other? I don't recall any other.
It seems to me there were shows. I just don't remember offhand, but I'm sure there had to be a few great radio shows.
Carlton E. Morse is still around, one of the fellows who played on One Man's Family, from the beginning right to the end.
Yes.
He was here about a year ago, and he said he lives on the peninsula there, and is rich and sees a lot of the people who worked on that show, you know, for so many years. I got a letter just today. I must ask you about this because you might have known some of them. It was a very moving letter. I'll show you when we finish recording, from a lady who lives out of New York, one of the suburbs, begging me to have the people on who were on Vic and Sage. I always mention on this point of all the people who write into me about movie stars and older TV personalities and so forth, the most mail I get is about Vic and Sage.
Is that right? Well, I used to know Bernadine. Bernadine,
sure.
Yes, I should say. I used to know Bernadine Flynn very well, who did the. She was Sade on the series. And she later married an obstetrician back there, Dr. Doherty. I don't think she's done anything in radio in a great number of years.
No, she still lives in Chicago, and she's still a member of AFTRA because I was there last winter, and I tried to call her, but she was out that day. I got her number from AFTRA. The man who played Vic is dead, and the fellow who wrote it, Reimer, was that it?
Yes.
He is dead. Rush.
Mm-hmm.
He still does, I understand, a local commercial on TV or radio from time to time, but he also has an executive job with one of the big Chicago ad agencies.
Yes, I knew all of them.
Very well remembered program. Very good.
Yes, it certainly was. Very,
good
very
reason.
Clever. Very, beautifully written, too. And beautifully played. Yeah. Wonderful cast. They were all pros.
Do you run into very often some of the old radio actors here in New York? A lot of them moved, I know, to New York when they.
Offhand, I can't think of the names offhand, but I guess we're brushing up against them week in and week out.
Very often I have more than one here, as I do for, you know, for when I do an old radio show, I'll have the lead and the leading lady or so forth, and they'll come in and say, oh, I haven't seen you in 17 years or 9 years or whatever it is. Or if they do, they just run into each other.
You know, I'll tell you a very funny little anecdote. At least I thought it was funny. It was back in 33 or 34 when Babe Ruth was at the pinnacle of his career. And he was called in to do one of the commercials for Wheaties. And we'll watch it. We won't quote him verbatim, but you can use your imagination. And he had one phrase in this, and he said he had the line, so tell your mummy to go out and buy these cookies. And every time he got up to this line, he said, so tell your mother to go out and buy these cookies, cookies. And he was corrected the first couple of times. He said he wasn't even conscious of it. And then from that point on, he went over the commercial five or six times because he wasn't very adept at reading, naturally. Finally, we hit the air over the complete Columbia network. And Babe gets to this line, and he comes up to me and he says, so tell your mother to go out and buy these cookies. He stopped for a moment and he said, I'm a son of a gun. I said cookies again.
That one took the car.
Yes. That was the Babe. Did I clean that up right? Huh? Okay. He wasn't quite that genteel. But a very funny.
I must have
it broke us all up.
Later, what the real word was. She's sitting in with us. Jim Amici, thanks very much for coming and being Jack Armstrong, the All-American Boy, here for us today. A couple people we'll be having in future weeks. Do you remember Chick Farmer, who wrote the Society column, and he was the greeter at the Stork Club? And Sherman Billingsley reigned supreme there over Brenda Fraser and people like that.
Heavens,
he's going to come on. And
it was an old stamping ground of ours back then.
Yeah, just everybody who was in went to the Stork Club.
Yes,
now Sherman Billingsley's gone, and Brenda Fraser is kind of out of the limelight in Boston. And we have a silent star. As a matter of fact, who is coming from Chicago, which is where she lives, Colleen Moore. One of the big superstars of silent screen and early talkies. She's written her autobiography, and I guess that's what she wants to talk about, among other things.
Well, wonderful.
And next week we're going to do television. Doesn't that make you feel old when you can say whatever became of someone in television? But the program is Super Circus, and Claude Kirshner, who's still very much around, is going to come and talk with us.
There's another Hartline. One of the old friends from back in the early days in Chicago. Yes, I should say.
Well, Mary Hartline is married to several millions of dollars, he tells me, and she couldn't make it, but she sends her best regards. So he'll be here next week, and we'll find out whatever became Super Circus. So thanks very much to Jim Amici.
Richard, I want to say it's been a tremendous pleasure, this little bit of nostalgia here, and I've enjoyed it tremendously.
Good. You must
thank
come back
so
again. Maybe we'll do another show like this.
Wonderful. Right.
So until next week at the same time, this is Richard Lamparski. Thank you for listening. Good night.